Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been asked to make a few reflections on the consent decree and the path that followed from it, so I would like to do that. We started at the State Hospital in 1973 as something that was known very politically incorrectly as the Mental Patients Advocacy Project, a name that we probably would not be using today. Mr. Goggins and Dr. Jacobs welcomed in a cadre of lawyers. We were among the first group of attorneys and the largest group of lawyers, I think, to find their way into a mental hospital anywhere in the United States. And we began representing people on the wards and in the hospital and at commitment hearings. And over again, we would approach them and ask them, what did they want? We asked David Brewster and Hector Santiago and Donald Gabori and Richard Snyder, what do you want? And over again, what they said to us is, we want to leave. We want to go home. So we went to their social workers and their clinicians and their doctors and said, David Brewster would like to leave. And the clinicians inevitably said to us, well, he should be able to leave. But unfortunately, there's nothing available for him. There is no place where he can go. So being lawyers, advocates, we went back and said, sign this 3-day notice. This will get you out. And they signed a 3-day notice in the hospital. Dr. Gallup or someone would inevitably file a commitment petition, and off we'd go to a hearing in the basement of the building that used to be over there with Judge Morse. And we would put on a good case, and Judge Morse would listen, and Dr. Geller or Dr. Gallup would testify that this person's got a mental illness, but they don't need to be at this hospital. And we think that they should leave, but unfortunately, there's no place where they can go and be safe. And Judge Morse, over and over and over again, would enter orders of commitment, often with sadness and almost always with exasperation, telling us, one of the things that Judge Morse did wonderfully was talk to people. He was a terrific judge. He would always explain his decision. And he would explain it to our client and to us, saying that he was sorry, he wished that they could leave, he thinks that they should leave, but until the Department of Mental Health was able to provide something for them in the community, they couldn't leave, and they'd be committed. All this was happening at a time and in a backdrop, some of the things Elaine talked about. There was a consent decree at Belchertown State School. Interestingly enough, that case is still going on. Yesterday, the First Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts could close the Fernald State School. But that was going on. There were cases all over the country, particularly in mental retardation facilities, establishing a right for people to live in the community when they didn't need to be in hospitals. There was also a lot of law. There was a very good federal statute establishing community mental health centers. Massachusetts had a wonderful statute, even in the early 70s, saying it was the policy of Massachusetts that people should live in the community in the least restrictive alternative. But the Department of Mental Health was without the resources to do that, and the community services just were not there. We would often, at the commitment hearings, have two options for people. If you were from Springfield, you could go to Mrs. Laragione's, if she had any openings. You remember that one? Yeah, not what we would say today was the greatest place to go. But she was a caring person who provided something for a lot of people who were able to leave. If you were from Franklin, Hampshire, you had an option of a couple of group homes. There were community mental health centers, but that was about it. There was a frustration at the hospital, there was a frustration among clinicians, and there was a clear frustration among the administration of the Department of Mental Health that something had to be done. So we did it. On December 15th in 1976, we filed a lawsuit, filed a complaint in the federal district court. It was one of the first complaints in the United States directed at a mental hospital as opposed to a mental retardation facility. It was a class action. We had 9 named individuals as plaintiffs, led by David Brewster. We were joined in the case by the Massachusetts Association of Mental Health, as far as I know, the only time that MAMH has been a plaintiff in a lawsuit, and by the Massachusetts Association for Retarded Citizens, now known as ARC Massachusetts. As Elaine Hill pointed out, the back wards of the Haskell building were a mental retardation facility. There were 2 back wards in this building with a number of individuals who had been moved from the Belchertown State School in order to get the census down there to Northampton State Hospital because they had co-occurring mental disorders with their mental retardation. So Mark was a plaintiff as well. The case is called Brewster versus Dukakis because Governor Dukakis was the governor and he was the first named plaintiff, first named defendant. Commissioner Robert Okun was a defendant, as was the late Ray Breen, who was then the regional director, that day's equivalent of the area director, and five of the area directors, Joe Van Honaker, Andy Phillips, Frank Robinson was a defendant, he's here, Carrie Holland, and Evelyn McLean. Dr. Jacobs, who was the superintendent, was a defendant. We were fortunate to draw Judge Frank Friedman as the judge in this case. At that time, Judge Friedman had just begun to move the federal court into Springfield so that there was a full-time federal court sitting in Springfield for the first time. The first year or so of the case was litigated. Surprisingly enough, or not surprisingly enough if you've ever been sued, although as Becky McCauley pointed out, we were somewhat invited to bring this lawsuit. When we brought it and people were actually served, the reaction was a little different than what we'd hoped for. And the case was contentious for about a year. A turning point in the case was when Steve Schwartz filed a motion asking the judge to invite the Department of Justice to join the case as a plaintiff. The Department of Justice has done a lot of litigation around the country on mental hospitals and had been very involved at that case at that time in Wyatt versus Stickney, which is the grandmother and grandfather of all the institutional cases. And that one just ended about 2 years ago. Judge Friedman said he wasn't going to do that, and he wanted the parties to start meeting together to try and see if they could settle the case. And if they couldn't, then he'd think about inviting justice in. It was at that point, I think, that the most remarkable part of the early stages of this case happened. We're very fortunate throughout the history of the case to have great representation from lawyers in the Department of Mental Health, particularly Dick Ames, and in the Attorney General's office from a long line of very good lawyers, Bill Pardee, Steve Rosenfeld, and others, Catherine White. A lot of lawyers in this case have gone on to be judges and commissioners in other areas, and as have a lot of the defendants. But the parties got together and began a planning process. And the planning process involved the local administrators from DMH, the lawyers from our side, and experts from that each side brought in. And the result of that planning was, I think, the first comprehensive look in the United States at a major geographical part of a state. A look into seeing how many people actually are out there with serious mental illness who might be in need of hospitalization, and what kind of services would be necessary to keep them from having to go to the hospital for any long period of time and to get them out. The consent decree itself is 31 pages. The planning document, which is attached to it, is 250 pages. And that's the document that came out of this planning process. And it said, we need so many residential programs. We need emergency services, which were unheard of at that time. We need community mental health centers. We need employment opportunities. We need job training and retraining for hospital staff. The decree was signed with that as the attachment on December 7th in 1978. Shortly before Governor Dukakis left office after being defeated in a primary election by Ed King earlier that year. The decree created an opportunity for perhaps the most comprehensive community-based mental health system in the United States. And despite a long period of resistance, particularly during the King administration until Governor Dukakis came back in, I think it's worked. And it's worked for a number of reasons. And these are some of the ones that I think are particularly important. We had in this state at that time, and in this part of the state in particular, an extraordinary collection of DMH administrators. And I don't say that just because they're all here. but it's true. We had people of vision, of commitment, and with a sense of values and hard work that really made it quite remarkable. We had good lawyers on our side and on the state side. We had a terrific administration in the Department of Mental Health most of the time at the state level. We had responsible and professional attorney generals, attorneys general, assistant attorney general. We had strong support from the court. Judge Friedman believed in this case, perhaps in part because he was very happy he didn't have to go to trial, and he was just able to oversee a consent decree, but he believed in it. We had remarkable court monitors. Michael Ponser, who was the first court monitor, was an extraordinary addition to the implementation of the decree, kept all of us working together, working in a toward common goals. And Joe Cecilia, who succeeded him when Michael Ponser went on to succeed Judge Friedman as the federal judge in Springfield, was also a very important factor in the decree. We had a committed, innovative, visionary group of providers. And it really is, when you think back, I was remembering with someone just a little earlier about the small agencies that started up with new ideas to serve elders, to serve people with severe medical problems, to serve people with dual diagnoses, and to do that against community resistance, to stand up in some of the areas where these programs are not welcome, to find new ways to deliver services. It was really very extraordinary. Another thing that I think is unique and remains unique is that Michael Hogan, when he was the regional director, brought in and infused throughout the system a clear values base.